From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Nick Hornby is no stranger to big screen adaptations of his best-selling novels. The movie version of his book, About a Boy, hits theaters today. It stars Hugh Grant and Toni Collette. We'll talk with Hornby, whose novels include How to Be Good and High Fidelity, which was adapted for the screen. Also, climbing Mount Everest. We'll meet Jamling Tenzing Norgay, who summited the mountain in 1996. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from singer Cassandra Wilson, and TV critic David Bianculli wraps up the May ratings sweeps. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The president is defending his handling of information he received a month before the September 11th terrorist attacks. The information warned about the possibility that al-Qaeda terrorists were planning to hijack U.S. airliners. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
In a terse statement at a Rose Garden event honoring the Air Force Academy football team, the president said that if he had any information allowing him to prevent the terrorist attacks, he would have done so. And he had this to say on the growing number of calls from Congress, from Democrats, and even some Republicans, for an investigation to find some answers.
You know what's interesting about Washington? It's a town, unfortunately, it's the kind of place where second-guessing has become second nature.
The president got words of support from his wife, who's currently touring Europe. In response to a reporter's question, Laura Bush described those who are criticizing the White House as playing on the victims' families' emotions. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
President Bush called on Congress today to reform the Medicare program. He told senior citizens gathered at the White House that Congress should pass legislation that would provide lower-cost options for health care coverage from Medicare and also give all seniors secure access to prescription drugs. He said that managed care programs should be included among the options. House Republicans have had to delay a vote on a Medicare reform bill that was set for next week because of disputes among party members over the costs. Republicans want their version of the prescription drug benefit to fit within the $350 billion they budgeted for drug benefits and to support managed care. Democrats are working on their own version of the bill. Floodwaters in the Mississippi River Valley could get worse before they get better over the next several days. Authorities are blaming the floodwaters for several deaths in Missouri. Kevin Lavery reports from member station KWMU in St. Louis.
At least 8 deaths have been reported along the Mississippi, Missouri, and Illinois rivers in recent days. The Coast Guard has suspended barge traffic throughout much of the Illinois River, which has risen to nearly 10 feet above flood stage in some areas. The Army Corps of Engineers operates the lock and dam system along the Mississippi River. Spokesman Alan Dooley says the Corps is trying to get rid of excess water through carefully timed releases from upstream reservoirs.
Of course, we can't just let the water go because we could discharge more water up here and it would exacerbate flooding to the south.
Commercial barge operators say the floods along the Illinois River have cost their industry more than $1 million over the past week. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Lavery in St. Louis.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 63 points to close at 10,353. The NASDAQ gained 11 points. This is NPR News. The Senate has approved a bill that supports expanding the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The measure, which now goes to President Bush, would also provide security assistance for 7 nations that are seeking membership in the military alliance. The bill authorizes more than $55 million in military assistance to be divided among Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Bulgaria, and Romania. Russia is abandoning a deal with OPEC countries on limiting exports of crude oil. Russia, along with other non-OPEC members, Mexico and Norway, agreed to the curbs in an effort to boost oil prices after the September 11th attacks. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports from Moscow.
Oil industry experts in Moscow said the Russian decision not to extend the deal with OPEC on crude exports was a mere formality. Russia stopped enforcing the agreement 2 months ago, and its independent oil producers are exporting record volumes for the third year in a row. Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov hinted there was no longer any need for Russia to support crude prices since they've already recovered to nearly $26 a barrel. That's close to pre-September 11th levels. Russia's the world's second largest exporter of crude oil. Crude dealers said the Russian decision to end export curbs had been widely anticipated and would not affect world oil prices. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
The British Coast Guard is standing by with ships and helicopters in case they're needed to evacuate nearly 900 people from a burning ferry in the North Sea. A Coast Guard spokesman told Sky News that the captain of the Princess of Scandinavia said an initial fire has been put out, but there's a secondary fire in the ship's funnel. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Rational, the software development company, providing integrated lifecycle tools, software engineering practices, and services on the web at rational.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. The new film About a Boy is based on Nick Hornby's novel about a callow bachelor as he drifts into middle age. Hornby is great at writing about men who avoid mature relationships by immersing themselves in pop culture. His novel High Fidelity featured a guy in his 30s who runs a used record store and judges everyone according to their taste in music. About a Boy focuses on Will, played by Hugh Grant, who lives off the royalties of his late father's novelty Christmas hit and spends his time listening to records and watching TV. He figures a good way to pick up women would be to pose as a single father. So he goes to a meeting for a support group called SPAT, Single Parents Alone Together.
Oh, me. Yes. Well, I have a 2-year-old, Ned. He's got blue eyes and sort of sandy-colored hair, and he's about 2'3". And his mum left.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously it was a very big shock because we were so happy, you know. Sandra's neurology practice was just up and running, and then one day her bags were packed and my best friend was waiting outside in his Ferrari. Yeah. You know, the moderner, the one with the supercharged engine where you can actually see the engine through the back window?
You got dumped then?
Yeah, yeah.
Through the support group, Will ends up bonding with a 12-year-old misfit named Marcus. Terry spoke with Nick Hornby in 1998, after the publication of About a Boy. They began with a reading in which Will considers his experiences with his current single-parent girlfriend, Angie, who has 2 children.
They went to McDonald's. They went to the Science Museum and the Natural History Museum. They went on a boat down the river. On the very few occasions when he had thought about the possibility of children, always when he was drunk, always in the first throes of a new relationship, he had convinced himself that fatherhood would be a sort of sentimental photo opportunity, and fatherhood Angie style was exactly like that. He could walk hand in hand with a beautiful woman, children gambling happily in front of him, and everyone could see him doing it, and when he'd done it for an afternoon, he could go home again if he wanted to. And then there was the sex. Sex with a single mother, Will decided after his first night with Angie, beat the sort of sex he was used to, hands down. If you pick the right woman, someone who'd been messed around and eventually abandoned by the father of her children, and who hadn't met anyone since, because the kids stopped you going out, and anyway, a lot of men didn't like kids that didn't belong to them, and they didn't like the kind of mess that frequently coiled around these kids like a whirlwind. If you pick one of these, then she loved you for it. All of a sudden, you became better looking, a better lover, a better person. As far as he could see, it was an entirely happy arrangement. All those so-so couplings going on out in the world of the childless singles, to whom a night in a foreign bed was just sex. They didn't know what they were missing. Sure, they were right on people, men and women, who would be repelled and appalled by his logic, but that was fine by him. It reduced the competition.
That's Nick Hornby reading from his new novel, About a Boy. The other advantage your main character finds in dating single mothers is that the single mothers are often not yet ready to be in a long-term relationship, so they break up apologetically with him, which means he gets to have great sex without commitment, and that's delightful for him.
That's his logic, yeah.
I think a lot of single mothers assume that men find them difficult because of the child. How did you come to see the other side of that?
Well, I know a fair few people who had gone out with almost a string of single mothers, and I think that for some of them it was kind of a rehearsal for what they wanted to do later on, but not something they were ready to do properly yet. And so these people kind of met their needs. I mean, that sounds cynical, but I don't think they were intending it to be cynical at the time. But I think it does have an appeal for men.
Your main character, Will, is actually very afraid of the idea of being a real father. He thinks that children really mess up people's lives and mess up people's marriages, and they're sloppy and messy and time-consuming. Did you go through a period of that yourself, watching your friends who were married and who were having children and who had less time for movies and books and soccer matches, the things that you're really obsessed with?
Well, I think that everyone who knows anyone with a child or has children themselves goes through this.
Did it make you think, well, I'm not going to fall into that trap and have children myself?
No. I mean, I have a child, so and it was a conscious decision to have a child, so clearly it didn't affect me all the way. But I think if you ask any parent, they have a fantasy that they want time and space. And of course, they wouldn't be without their children, but time and space is a really big deal.
The main character in your book ends up meeting a 12-year-old who's the son of the friend of the woman he's dating. And a lot of the book is about their relationship. And, you know, his mother, the teenager's mother, is a vegetarian who won't let him eat at McDonald's or wear Adidas sneakers or listen to the current rock hits. She likes to sing old Joni Mitchell songs. And that's where your main character comes in. He's a pop culture maven, and he can tell the kid about Kurt Cobain and buy him stylish sneakers. Do you think that parents often make a mistake when they try to regulate their kids' pop culture diets?
Yeah, I think this is a very difficult line to draw. When I was growing up as a kid in England, I was voracious in my consumption of pop culture. But that still actually left me quite a lot of free time because TV, we had some Saturday morning TV when I was kind of older, and there was an hour of children's television between 5 and 6 every evening. But that was it. There was no daytime stuff. We had one pop channel on the radio, so I could consume all I like, and it didn't, as I say, it didn't take up too much of my time. But I think now parents are faced with a different set of problems.
The main character in your book is wants to be basically a pop culture mentor to the 12-year-old who enters his life. And I think that that's the fantasy that a lot of adults have, a lot of adults who are really deep into music and movies and television, that, well, maybe it's hard for them to relate to teenagers, but they can relate to teenagers on the basis of, you know, movies and books and television shows and all of that. Was that a fantasy of yours that, you know, you would have this kind of natural connection to teenagers, no matter how alienated the teenagers were?
I taught for a while, and part of the reason that I wanted to teach was because I thought, you know, I could connect with kids because I knew who the Sex Pistols were and who played for Manchester United. But you kind of get disabused of that very quickly, I think, because any cool kid really doesn't want to know what an old guy, especially an old guy who's a teacher, has to say about anything at all. Marcus, in the book, he knows nothing, and because he knows nothing, he's struggling at school. So Will can fulfill a need in him.
But you found it hard to fulfill that need as a teacher. Well, the kids didn't have that need, I guess. I mean,
yeah, exactly. I mean,
they already knew stuff.
Yeah, when one has the fantasy that you're talking about, I think it's quite right. Adults do have that fantasy, and you have the fantasy that you're going to be sitting down with the coolest kid in the class and talking about, you know, REM or Nirvana. And they really don't want to hear from you, those kids.
I'll tell you what I think the fantasy really is, too, that a lot of people in their 30s, 40s, and maybe early 50s have. I think it's this, that when they were teenagers, they were much hipper than their parents were. But now that they're adults, they're a lot hipper than their kids are. Don't you think?
I think that's absolutely right, yes.
How old were your students when you taught?
I taught 11 to 16-year-olds.
And you were teaching them English?
Yeah.
And what did you feel you could best relate to them about?
Actually, soccer was okay, because there isn't a kind of hip thing or an unhip thing. There's just kind of knowledge, really. And you can just talk to kids about sport as equals, whereas I think with pop music, there's always a lot of jousting going on. And if you're older than, obviously a teacher, you're older than your kids, and I think you always want to say to them, yeah, well, they're good, but, you know, have you listened to the Velvet Underground? Because that's where they're getting this stuff from. And that's where the kids start to, you know, they start to roll their eyeballs and walk away from you.
One of the things I found very amusing in your novel is when the adult character, Will, decides, you know, he'll spend a day with the 12-year-old and try to keep him entertained, but he can't think of, well, what should I do with him? What's going to keep him amused? The kid wants to go to Planet Hollywood, which is about the last place that Will, the main character, wants to go to. And that really made me think about how difficult it is, I think, when there are children in your life who want to go to all these kind of big pop culture extravaganza type things that you might really hate, that you might think are just like the tackiest, most kind of false and corporate things out there. But what can you do? I mean, the kid wants to go. What are you going to do?
I mean, a lot of that is about belonging to mainstream, and Marcus is desperate to belong to the mainstream. You know, he's desperate to be able to go to school and say that he went to Planet Hollywood, because he doesn't have very many ways in which he can relate to his classmates. And I think, again, when you're hip, as Will thinks he is, the last thing you want to do is belong to the mainstream. You want to take people away from the mainstream, tell them a place that maybe they don't know about. And, of course, that's precisely not the point for Marcus. He has to go somewhere where he does know about.
Nick Hornby's novel About a Boy has been adapted into a film. It opens today. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to Terry's interview with Nick Hornby. The new film About a Boy is based on his 1998 novel.
There's a lot of depression in your new book. The mother of the teenage boy is a suicidal depressive. Kurt Cobain kills himself during the course of the book. There's a teenager who's a depressive. Were you thinking about how frightening it must be for young people when there are people who are chronically depressed in their life, and how difficult it must be to understand and to cope with?
Yeah, I'd had bouts of depression myself in my late 20s. And it is something that interests me, I think, depression. I think probably all three of my books have dealt with depression in some way or another. I think Rob in High Fidelity is kind of gloomy, if not depressed, and I wanted to take that a step further. But one of the things that I do in spare time is I'm a patron of a children's charity called Young Minds, which is actually supposed to deal with kids who have mental health problems. I mean, not handicaps, but mental health problems. There's no other charity like it in the UK, and that is something that I think is incredibly important, that we tend to underestimate kids' depression.
Do you think you had depression as a kid?
Yeah, I think probably I did, actually, for a couple of years in my early teens. I mean, maybe I was just having teenage blues, but I think for all of us it's very hard to separate one from the other.
How did it manifest itself?
Gloominess, really. Great desire to be on my own for chunks of the day and read and listen to music with headphones on. I mean, you know, anyone who's got a teenage kid, I think, recognises these symptoms. Whether one would classify it as depression or not, I'm not sure. It felt like it at the time.
Do you think that depression kind of helps feed your recorded movie and television and book habits, you know, your obsessions with immersing yourself in that part of life?
I think that's right. I think that, I've always had a theory that obsessives do have some sense of depression, and that obsession is a form of oblivion in a way. That, you know, if you can train yourself to spend 3 or 4 hours in a second-hand record shop flicking through album sleeves, that you don't have to think about anything else. So I think that there's got to be something of that in there. But I think that depression's definitely fueled my writing, and I think that one of the things that strikes a chord with people is that a lot of them are gloomy.
A lot of the characters are gloomy?
No, that a lot of the readers are gloomy, and they kind of recognise that. I mean, it's a lot of it is a comedy born of glumness.
Nick Hornby is my guest, and his new novel, which we're talking about, is called About a Boy. I read in a review of one of your books that your son is autistic, and I was thinking, you know, after reading this book about an adult who first relates to a teenager, you know, who first has a teenager come into your life, how totally unprepared you must have been to have a child who is autistic and who is going to be, you know, very different from whatever expectations you had when you decided you were going to become a father.
Yeah, I think especially if you make your living out of words, the kind of basic expectation you have as a parent is that whatever else you're going to be able to talk to your kid. My kid doesn't talk, so that was a huge readjustment to have to learn about.
You probably also had all these fantasies about being this kind of pop culture mentor to your child. You're teaching them about your favorite books and records and movies, etc.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of do that. My son really likes music, and he watches a lot of videos, although he watches the same sort of 4 videos over and over again. But that's not such a big deal, really. I'm sure that he will respond to music in some form or another. I think that you just have to be inventive in the ways that you relate.
How much time... I know you're also separated. How much time can you spend with your son now?
Well, I see him every day. I live and work around the corner, so I give him his bath every day, and I give him lunch a couple of times a week when he's not at school, so... And I spend weekends with him, so it's really not very much less than it ever was.
I'm wondering how it's hard to answer questions like this without, you know, being false, I think, but how do you think you've been changed by having a son who is autistic and being exposed to a completely different way of relating to the world?
That is a very hard question to answer. I think that it's made me tougher in some ways. That I think when I first started writing and the writing really took off quite quickly in England with my first book, and I think it's quite easy to get overwhelmed in those circumstances, that you end up doing what people want you to do, and it's hard to say no to things. But the moment that Danny was diagnosed, it became much easier in a way to keep time for yourself and to almost hide behind him to a certain extent. You can afford to be much tougher with people as a result of something like that.
What do you mean to be tougher with people?
It's very easy for me now to tell people to shove off if they're kind of getting in my face or wanting to take up time. Because the time is for Danny. Also, money is for Danny as well. So it kind of makes you feel better about earning. And, you know, I've earned quite well over the last few years. And that makes you feel kind of weird, I think, at first, because you think, what's all this for? But now I know what it's all for.
Right. My guest is Nick Hornby, and he's the author of the new novel About a Boy. You're... current novel About a Boy is going to be adapted into a movie, I think, by Robert De Niro's production company. And your previous novel, High Fidelity, is being made into a movie. And I think your first book, Fever Pitch, about soccer, was already made into a movie that didn't make it into the States. Have you had any input into the screenplays for any of those films?
I wrote the screenplay for Fever Pitch. So that I had sort of very close involvement with, and I was really working with friends on the project, and that was a great experience. But the other two I just sold on, and I haven't had any involvement in them so far. I'm actually going to meet the guy who's adapting About a Boy tomorrow, so I'll be talking to him about it then, but it's his business now.
How do you feel about that, about handing over control of your characters to someone else?
I feel absolutely fine about it. It was, but High Fidelity and About a Boy were conceived as books, and I'm happy with the books, and that was kind of the end of the process for me. And if people want to take it on and try and do something else with it, I think that they're perfectly at liberty to do so. I think, you know, it's a straightforward transaction with writing, that if you want to sell your film rights, then do so, but don't whine about what happens afterwards.
The title of your new book, About a Boy, is named after a record. Do you want to talk a little bit about the record you named it after and why?
It's quite complicated. It turns out it's named after several records. I thought of the title after the Nirvana song About a Girl. The book is set in at the end of 93, beginning of 94, and Kurt Cobain's death does feature in it, so it seemed entirely appropriate. And the boy, as in About a Boy, I think it could refer to either Marcus or Will. But then I remembered, actually, I had completely forgotten that Patti Smith wrote a song called About a Boy, about Kurt Cobain, so I guess I must have pinched her title rather than the Nirvana title.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Nick Hornby talking with Terry Gross in 1998. His novel About a Boy has been made into a film. It opens today. Hornby's most recent book, How to Be Good, is just out in paperback. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Aging with Grace, What the Nun Study Teaches Us About Leading Longer, Healthier, and More Meaningful Lives by David Snowden, Ph.D., now in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, climbing Mount Everest. We'll talk with Jamling Tenzing Norgay, who made his ascent in 1996. His father, Sherpa Tenzing Norgay, accompanied Sir Edmund Hillary on the first summit of the mountain. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from singer Cassandra Wilson, and TV critic David Bean Cooley talks about May sweeps. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Before Cassandra Wilson moved to New York in the 1980s and became one of the acclaimed jazz singers of our time, she was a guitar-strumming singer-songwriter back in Jackson, Mississippi. For her new album, Belly of the Sun, Wilson returned to her home state to soak up some down-on-the-delta atmosphere and record with a few local musicians. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's a homecoming in more ways than one.
When it's darkness on the delta, that's the time my heart is light. When it's darkness on the delta, let me linger in the shelter of the night.
Cassandra Wilson and pianist Boogaloo Ames with a Mildred Bailey number from the 1930s. It's the only piano-dominated track on an album thick with guitars. Wilson recorded most of it in an old train station and boxcar in Mississippi blues country, a good gimmick if nothing else. Like the well-hyped debut by fellow Blue Note artist Nora Jones, who sounds like a sleep-deprived Bonnie Raitt, Wilson's Belly of the Sun targets pop buyers more than hardline jazz fans. Critic Martin Johnson has made the good point that Jones's twangy CD reaches out to roots music fans whipped up by the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. Some of Wilson's album is cut from the same gunny sack.
Gotta move. You gotta move. You gotta move, child. You gotta move. And when the law
besides the old bluesy numbers, Wilson's album has a few of her own songs, one a winner called Drunk as Cooter Brown. She also covers tunes by the band, Bob Dylan and Glenn Campbell, the pop music of the 60s and 70s when Wilson was learning guitar and started singing in coffee houses. With her dusky contralto voice, she's the most sultry sounding of the modern jazz singers who ooze their way around a tune, like Diana Krall. But sometimes, Wilson overindulges that side. She sings The Weight with a lot less urgency than the band's Levon Helm. When Glenn Campbell sang Jim Webb's Wichita Lineman, he had to reach for the climactic high notes. The soaring melody gave you an idea of how the world looks from the top of a utility pole. Wilson sings it lower in her range, so she doesn't have to reach. But staying closer to the ground, she misses the view from up there.
I hear him singing through the wires. I can hear him through the wine, but my Wichita lineman is still on the line.
On a typical jazz vocal record, a bossa nova might be the mellow interlude, but Cassandra Wilson gets so laid back, a Brazilian number makes her snap too. This is Antonio Carlos Jobim's Waters of March.
A spear, a spike, a point, a nail, a trip, a drop. The end of a tale, a truckload of bricks in the soft morning light. The sound of a gun in the dead of the night. A mile, a muster, thrust, a bump. It's a girl, it's a rhyme, it's a cold. The mumps, the plan of the house, the body in bed, and the car that got stuck. It's the mud, a float, a drift of light, a wing, a hawk, a queen. The promise of spring and the riverbank charts are the waters of March, the end of all strain, the joy in your heart.
That's goosebump good. The wordy lyric gives her no time to slack off. Belly of the Sun reminds me of classic albums Van Morrison made when Wilson was a teen, like Astral Weeks or Moondance. Morrison also wrote guitar-based songs with jazzy overtones and liked to stretch a few syllables putting one over. In record stores, you find Van Morrison under pop, not jazz. Lucky for him, as pop sells way better. If it seems odd that Cassandra Wilson's or Nora Jones's CD is on Blue Note, the jazz division of Mega Mega Capitol Records, you can take it as a sign that the idea of listening to a jazz singer appeals to record buyers' sense of sophistication, even if they don't really like straight-up jazz records. A singer friend of mine also suggests that typing this music as jazz saves it from the odious tag of adult contemporary music. Who wants to be seen buying that?
He was drunk as Cuda Brown. Words fell from his tongue with a slurring silver sound. He'd come this way from the other side of town. He was drunk as Cuda Brown. And his coat hung round his shoulders with a gangster.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Belly of the Sun, the new CD by Cassandra Wilson. Coming up, Climbing Everest. This is Fresh Air. My guest Jamling Tenzing Norgay literally followed in his father's footsteps, which wouldn't be all that remarkable, except that these particular footsteps led all the way to the top of Mount Everest. In 1953, Sir Edmund Hillary and Sherpa Tenzing Norgay made the first grueling journey to the summit of the mountain. In preparation for the 50th anniversary of the ascent, Hillary's son Peter and Norgay's son Jamling Tenzing Norgay are now on the mountain, filming the National Geographic special Sons of Everest. Norgay's own son, Tashi, just reached the summit yesterday on a separate expedition. Jamling Tenzing Norgay summited in 1996. In his memoir, Touching My Father's Soul, he writes of the spiritual significance climbing the world's highest mountain holds for him and once held for his father.
You know, there's something about it that called him to the mountain all the time. And ever since he was a small boy, he had dreams of climbing this mountain, and always, you know, he was always attracted to it. And in the lectures that I followed, I followed with him, and I heard from him, he talked a lot about, you know, the experience of climbing. But when I personally sat down to talk to him, he would not talk to me too much about the climbing techniques, but more about what the mountain was, what the mountain meant to him. And those were all in the religious sense, because Mount Everest, we call Chomo Longma, and the deity that resides on Everest, Mio Langsangma, you know, she's the deity that my father worshipped. And he always, you know, told me, you know, that you should always respect the mountains, because they are the abode of the snows where the gods live. And he, I think, had a different view, you know, like just like I do. And I learned from him and from other Sherpas about viewing mountains differently than just another rock.
Now, your father was celebrated around the world after he made it to the summit with Sir Edmund Hillary in 1953. He was awarded the George Medal from the Queen of England. You were born 13 years later. How did your father's fame affect your family life? How did you feel it as a kid?
Life for us was normal in while we went to school in Darjeeling, because my father lived there. You know, he was just a normal person there. Being his son, you know, being the son of a famous father, he was away a lot. We were in boarding school. You know, for 12 years we were in boarding school.
This is you and your brothers?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Me and my two brothers, Norbu and Dame, and my sister, Dicky. You know, all of us were in boarding school. So, you know, I personally didn't have much time to spend with him and, you know, to be with him.
So you missed him as a kid?
Yes. I think I missed him as a kid and as a young adult. And just when I was in my teens is when I came to the U.S. to go to school, and then he passed away before, you know, it was too late to learn anything. And I think my whole motivation to pursue climbing this mountain was to try to learn, you know, what I had missed, you know, while my father was alive.
At the time that you were invited to be part of the IMAX filming expedition, what was your climbing experience? What mountains had you climbed?
I was in the U.S. for almost 9 or 10 years, and before that, I had done some climbing in the Sikkim Himalayas, and these are all small mountains. We call them, you know, trekking peaks, and they can range up to 21 to 22,000 feet from 18,000. And in 92, I did a small expedition, a solo expedition, to do some 5 summits in Sikkim. And as far as high altitude, you know, I had not been up above 21,500 or so. And this was my first high altitude, you know, high, big mountain.
Were you afraid that maybe you didn't have the strength or the skill to make it to the top, given that all the other members of the expedition had significant experience in high altitudes?
No, you know, this is something that I felt ever since I was a boy, that I was going to climb Mount Everest sooner or later. And I was confident, even when I was at the age of 18, when I asked my father I wanted to climb this mountain, I was very confident of, you know, getting to the top. And not because of my strength, but it's just I had faith in myself and in the mountain that, you know, I was going to climb this mountain one day. And as far as being fit for this mountain, you know, I was a Sherpa, you know, by ethnic group, my, you know, being a Sherpa and being the son of Tenzin Norgay also, I think, gave me a boost that, you know, I have it in my blood to climb this mountain and to do what my father had done before.
Do you mean that literally, physiologically?
Yes. I think we, the Sherpas, are believed, you know, to have, you know, bigger lungs. And, you know, we adapt to higher altitudes a lot faster and, you know, easily than any other humans in the planet here.
You were offered the position of climbing leader on the expedition. What were you responsible for?
Well, my responsibilities, you know, climbing Everest in 96 and when my father climbed Everest in 1953 were, we had very, it was very similar, you know, in regard to my father and my role. And my role was to help, you know, get all the loads up to the higher camps, make sure that all the camps are well stocked and the campsites are put up, the fixed ropes are up. You know, I organized groups of Sherpas who would fix the ropes on the mountain.
These are the ropes that the climbers
use and
attach their gear to.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And I was more of a liaison between the Sherpas and the members, because I, you know, I could speak English and I can speak Nepali and Sherpa, and because sometimes you can get into some misunderstanding between the members and the Sherpas.
Now, the first really dangerous part of the climb is called the Khumbu Icefall. What
yes.
makes it so dangerous? And you point out that it's particularly dangerous for Sherpas carrying loads.
Yes, yes. Now, the Khumbu Icefall is a very, it's almost like a large river of ice boulders moving, you know, a couple of feet a day. And you never know when these boulders are going to collapse, or it's sort of a labyrinth of, you know, these ice blocks. And you don't know when one of the crevices is going to open or close, or, you know, you might be on a ladder crossing one of the crevices, and all of a sudden if it closes or opens, then you're in trouble. Or, you know, a boulder falls on you, and it's very unpredictable in this area, especially in the later part of the day, because as the sun comes out, you know, ice melts and it gets warmer and there's more movement. And Sherpas are more, you know, they risk their lives a lot more than anyone else because they ferry loads up to the higher camps, you know, a lot more. I mean, in one climb or one, you know, one climb on Everest, I think, or on average, a Sherpa goes through the ice fall maybe about 18, 20 times, maybe more. And whereas a Westerner would probably go up the ice fall maybe like 4 times or 5 times at the most. And so that way, you know, the Sherpas, they risk their lives, you know, a lot more.
How many times did you pass through it on the 1996 expedition?
I went through the ice fall maybe about 9 or 10 times. And I did not go through it as much as, you know, the other Sherpas did. And I went through it with the team members because we were doing the film. We were filming and I had to be with them all the time. And it was not something that I look forward to going through because every time it, you know, the icefall would change. If we went through it, you know, today and 3 days later when we go through it again, you know, it looked a little different. And so, you know, the ladder's been moved. And we had a team of Sherpas that maintained the icefall for 2 months. The sole job was to go up and down the icefall every morning. That was like 3-4 in the morning, then go up to make sure that the route was still safe. If it wasn't, their job was to fix the icefall and then come back.
While your team was waiting to summit, at the same time, a sudden storm came up and endangered the lives of another expedition. 8 climbers lost their lives in that storm. The story is told in John Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air, and a number of other books about the trip. At what point did you know that the climbers making the ascent on May 10th, 1996, were in trouble?
You know, I think we sensed trouble that afternoon when we, looking through the telescope, you know, up on the ridge between the Hillary Step and the South Summit. We can see climbers, they were still up there at about 3 o'clock. You know, they were going for the summit. And immediately David looked at me, you know, David Brashears and Robert Schauer and Ed Wiesters, you know, we looked at each other and said, you know, the communication between our eyes was like, there is going to be trouble because it is very late, you know, to be up that high on the mountain at that time.
Where were you on the mountain?
We were lower down in Camp 2, which is at about 21,000 feet, 21,500 feet. And we can see straight up on, you know, on Mount Everest. And we noticed that, you know, when people were still climbing at that time, we wondered why, what was going on. And we even sort of partly felt that there might be trouble. Even the day before when we saw all these 30-some-odd people going up towards the last camp. And there were quite a few of them that were inexperienced, and they were very slow.
I think a lot of people thought in the wake of this that too many inexperienced climbers can pay a high price and attempt a summit and in the process endanger the lives of guides and also of Sherpas.
Others, yes, yes.
What's your perspective on that?
I feel that if a person wants to endanger their lives, you know, that is not right. I mean, at least if you want to climb Everest, you should come there with some experience or have climbed some other mountains. The commercial teams should screen the climbers before taking them on, you know, a big mountain and a dangerous mountain like Mount Everest.
I think your father attempted Everest 7 times. Is it something
Yes.
you wanted to do again?
No, my father tried, you know, 6 times, and then on the 7th attempt, he finally made it because this is something he wanted to do all his life. And after the 7th time when he finally made it, he did not have, you know, he did not even attempt to climb Everest. And I was very lucky to have made it on my first attempt, and I don't have any plans to go back again because, you know, I have completed my goal, you know, I have fulfilled my dream, of following my father's footsteps and being there with him. And I don't see any reason to go back again, because it's done. And, I'm happy with what I have and, you know, what I've learned from, you know, this mountain.
Jamling Tenzing Norgay, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara.
Jamling Tenzing Norgay, son of Sherpa Tenzing Norgay, who accompanied Sir Edmund Hillary to the top of Mount Everest. He's currently on the mountain filming the National Geographic special Sons of Everest. Coming up, May sweeps. This is Fresh Air. In television, the May ratings sweeps, the competitive period in which networks try to attract as many viewers as possible to set advertising rates for the fall, are just about over. According to our TV critic David Bianculli, so is his patience.
This Sunday in primetime, the networks are aiming their biggest guns at one another in what amounts to a high-stakes game of chicken. CBS is showing its two-hour finale of Survivor, which up until now always has aired on Thursdays, and following that with a live Survivor reunion special hosted by Rosie O'Donnell. ABC has a two-hour finale of The Practice, with Bobby preparing to defend his own wife, Lindsay, on murder charges. Fox has the very last episode of The X-Files, with the return of David Duchovny. It promises to answer some, though probably not all, of the questions that are out there. And finally, NBC has The Cosby Show, a look back, the zillionth reunion special this month, but not the last. Still to come before the sweeps are over next week? 20 years of must-see TV, a self-congratulatory NBC special on Monday, and an ABC special called That's Incredible, The Reunion. I know I've complained about this before, but what I find incredible is that That's Incredible, a terrible TV series from the 80s, is having a reunion. What I also find incredible is that TV can go weeks and even months with reruns and boring programming, then generate a lot of strong stuff and throw it all on at the same time on the same night. Sunday presents an especially tough choice, but in this case, because of the different natures of the shows, there's a relatively easy way out. Except for The Practice, which you can skip now and catch this summer in reruns, watch them all, just not at the same time. The X-Files, even for those fans who gave up on the show years ago, should be considered home base. That's the show to watch the most, and especially as it ends in the last few minutes of Sunday's primetime. You want to watch Survivor just before the final hour of primetime begins to see who won, and earlier, during any commercial break in The X-Files, to catch the progress as the other finalists are eliminated. As for the Cosby reunion, the part not to miss there is at the very start, when the star takes the stage and does a short but sweet stand-up act about his very successful TV series.
I guess if someone asked, what was it about, what is it about, how did it about? It was because I was confused. When I became a parent, I had certain thoughts, and things didn't go according to the thoughts. You would think that a person having been a child would understand how to raise. But it really doesn't work that way. When we put together a family, the husband, the wife, they start out their lives to become these great people. And they become great people, and then they ruin it. decide to have, and then you've got to go through things. You've got to go through teaching things. You would think that a young person that you're feeding, clothing, taking, saving the life of, would believe you every once in a while when you gave them some information. Not so, said the brown turtle.
The rest of the Cosby Show you can sample, if you follow this, when nothing's happening on Survivor during the X-Files commercials. But is this what it's come to? That we have to watch TV like we're air traffic controllers, keeping our eyes on lots of different things at the same time? This condition, though, is purely temporary. And that's what annoys me most of all. You've seen the ads on TV this month. Only two more episodes of this. Only one more episode of that. Don't miss this because it's the last show. Say goodbye to that. What the networks really are doing is hanging out a giant close for the summer sign. After next week, there will be no more new West Wing episodes for 4 months. No new episodes of 24 for at least that long, and maybe closer to 6. And so on. Instead, the networks already are looking ahead to the fall, and this week they just finished unveiling their new schedules and tastes of their new shows to advertisers. Well, I was there, and based on most of what I saw in New York this week, it's not going to be worth the wait. The networks spend all of May encouraging us to leave for the summer, then most of September trying to lure us back. It's a stupid way to do business. Then again, when it takes millions of dollars and dozens of executives to come up with remakes of Family Affair and The Twilight Zone, maybe it's just a stupid business.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Seuss Boland directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, A Mind at a Time, we'll talk with Dr. Mel Levine about the nature of learning differences among children and the limitations of standardized testing and teaching methods. Levine has a vision of schools for all kinds of minds. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.